Okay, this is the hour. We'll also take your phone calls with Robert Zimmerman, our science advisor and space historian. Some of his books, Genesis, The Story of Apollo 8, The Universe in a Mirror, Leaving Earth, The Chronological Encyclopedia of Discoveries in Space, and his website, BehindTheBlack.com, is linked up at CoastToCoastAM.com. We'll be back in a moment. We'll take your calls next. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, along with Robert Zimmerman, our science advisor, space historian. Robert, what projects are you working on now?
I have a policy paper that is just going to press right now, done for a think tank in Washington. This sounds really, I know, boring to most of your listeners, but this won't be. It's basically outlining how the American launch industry has been shifted in the last two decades, and how commercial space and competition is shaking everything up. And it's a policy paper that is going to hit Washington in about a month, and it's going to hit on every staffer's desk and every politician in both campaigns for president. And I expect it to really change policy in Washington, D.C. on the space program. That's at least what's coming up. That's the big thing, and that's going to make a big difference, I think.
When do you think we're going to have full capabilities to launch a human being again?
Well, that's what's going on right now with both SpaceX and Boeing. I mean, they are looking at 2018 right now for Boeing. Until earlier this week, they were looking at late 2017 for SpaceX. I think both in 2018. Back a deck, almost in 2010, I came on your show shortly after the Obama administration canceled the Constellation program,
yeah,
and the private companies' cargo missions hadn't yet flown. And I said then, we're in a period of transition, and the next decade is going to be difficult because we're transitioning from a Soviet-style program to a robust, chaotic private industry, and we're still in that transition. And, it has two steps forward, one step back. But that transition is clearly happening. It's very clear right now that competition is a better way to do things. One of the points in my paper, which is really easy to digest, is that they have spent about $43 billion on Orion and SLS, which is the government program, and they're producing three capsules and two rockets. And the private enterprise is going to produce for about $12 billion. That's a quarter the price. 43 capsules and 43 rockets. And just those numbers are pretty astonishing. It shows you that private enterprise and capitalism and freedom and competition can produce fast a lot. And so I think what's going to happen in the coming years is we're going to increasingly shift to private enterprise in space, and that's going to be really exciting.
Are most of the employees at these private companies, are they former NASA employees?
It's a mixed bag. I would say that more often than not, you've got a handful of old NASA experts near the top management. Many of those people are people that quit NASA out of frustration. They couldn't build anything. And they got jobs at SpaceX or elsewhere, Blue Origin.
And I'm sure they're doing better financially this way.
And they're doing maybe better financially, maybe not. But what's really, most of the people that work under them are young people who want an opportunity to actually cut metal, build things, and have it fly. And the people who work for SpaceX and Blue Origin, they got to build something that NASA and companies were telling us was impossible for literally a half a century, a vertically landing first stage rocket. And they built it and proved it can be done. And so most of the people at these companies are young, but they've got a good sprinkling of older, experienced people who want to build and make things and innovate and be creative. And what's the problem with a program is that it's too rules from above and too, planned, and therefore you can't innovate, you can't be creative, and what ends up happening is you can't build anything. And that's what we've had from our American space program now for literally almost a half century. We haven't done anything. And now we're going to look, it's an interesting thing. SpaceX, Elon Musk said he's going to fly a Dragon capsule to Mars with every orbital launch opportunity beginning in 2018. Now, the accident this week might delay that, but nonetheless, he's going to take advantage of every launch opportunity to test a capsule going to Mars. It's not a capsule designed to put people on it, but to a Mars mission. But eventually, he's going to learn how to do it by taking advantage of every launch opportunity, a very aggressive approach to exploring the solar system. Well, we haven't gotten that kind of aggressive approach from our space program ever, and not since the 60s at least. And so this is what competition, private enterprise, and letting individuals follow their dreams results in, real achievement.
I'm going to give you the names of the countries, and you tell me where they are on the pecking order of being able to launch men or women into space. First of all, the United States. Where would you put us on the list?
Well, it's an interesting, we're kind of weird. We can't put people in space right now. Yet we have the world's leading planetary space science program without question. No one else can do what we can do when it comes to planetary unmanned probes. Our manned program continues to be non-existent, though it's being built right now in multiple ways. In terms of pecking order, I would say because of the nature of our country, we still would be number one in my mind.
How about Russia?
Russia, I would say right now, is number three. They have the capability of putting people in space, which we don't have, but they have extreme financial problems because of the drop in oil prices and a very lackluster economic system. They have not really been able to figure out how to do capitalism properly, and so therefore they have a very corrupt social structure, which is crippling them. It's preventing them from developing and innovating, doing new things. They are. You might say they're number one in some ways, and you might say they're number two in others, but I see them fading. This is a horse race, and we're in the stretch. The U.S. and China are racing neck and neck, with China slightly ahead, slightly, but maybe not, but Russia is fading in the stretch. That's how I see those three.
And India?
India is an interesting, they're in the back. They have much limited capabilities, but they are a serious player in this. They are moving hard, and the country is space happy. So that makes it, they have great potential. They are trying to make money from space using a government program, which is a very problematic way of doing things, but because they're trying to make money, it puts pressure on them to do it smart and creatively.
I like the movie The Martian because it was the Chinese who stepped up to the plate to help get him back. And why don't we just get together through the United Nations, possibly, which I don't think has done much, and work out a national space program, space program.
George, I think I've been saying this a lot in all the years I've been on your show, but I despise the idea of this idea of cooperation and work together.
How come it saved money?
It repeatedly, competition is what makes things go. And I really like the fact that the Chinese, though they want to be, you know, they want to have a, you know, docking capabilities that everyone can use just in case something goes wrong. And they want to at least have some mutual working together in some ways. But I really like the fact that they have been independent, have their own program, and they're competing and they're trying to show everybody else up. And I like that because that means that we suddenly have to sweat and say, well, maybe we got to beat them. And so you get competition, you get some creativity, and you get new things going on. When we try to work together, what you get is gigantic bureaucracies and not much gets done. I just described the International Space Station, by the way.
Yes, you did.
That describes it very well.
What are they doing up there?
Well, you see, it's an international cooperation mission to show how we all live together, and so it limits what can be accomplished. The space station, Leaving Earth, my book Leaving Earth was all about this. You build a space station nowadays to learn how to build an interplanetary spaceship. The Chinese know this. That's why their space station.
And you launch from up there, right?
And the Russians knew that with Mir. International Space Station is a political game, and therefore it wasn't designed with that in mind, and therefore it doesn't teach us what we need to know to build an interplanetary spaceship the way it should. And so what do they do up there? They try to do some of the very things you need to do to learn how to build that spaceship, including medical research, but they are somewhat crippled because the design was not with that in mind. And so therefore it really doesn't teach you how to build that kind
Could of the ISS, does it have the capability of going to Mars?
No.
And going around it?
No. It doesn't have the engines, but even if you put the engines on it, it was designed to be operated, a great percentage of it, by mission control on the ground. And therefore, it can't leave orbit. It's not designed to be an independent flying ship. On top of that, a lot of its design was very, very sophisticated and complicated in conjunction with the space shuttle, the idea that you could haul things up and down very easily, a lot of cargo. Well, if you're going to Mars, you won't have that capability. And in fact, without the shuttle now, the station has been somewhat had a problem because they don't have the cargo capabilities going up and down that they used to. It's one of the reasons we, doing our spacewalks, have had some problems the last few years because our spacesuits are very complicated and they have to be hauled up and down to be maintained, and they can't be hauled up and down and maintained like they used to. So no, it's not an interplanetary spaceship. It couldn't go to Mars, and it can't even be adapted easily to go to Mars. However, I will tell you, the Russian part of it was designed to be able to be separated, and the Russians are talking about when 2024 rolls around and ISS is supposed to be abandoned, they will detach their modules that they built for themselves and put them together with some of the other modules and make their own independent space station, which would have the capability of being a test interplanetary ship.
To the phones now we go. Charles in Baltimore to get us started on the wild card line. Charles, go ahead.
Yes, and thank you very much. I have some questions.
Sure.
Say, for example, if civilians were allowed to go up on the space station, we'll say as a moving object. Okay, I guess I don't know how big it is. I'm blind, so I assume it would be something the size of maybe two or three or four mobile homes put together. Would that be about it?
No, it's actually a little larger than that.
It's
got about, I think nowadays, about 20,000 cubic square feet, which it's very important to understand in zero gravity. A room is much larger than on Earth because the same size room, because you can use the ceiling and the walls, so you actually get like twice to three times as much space. It's quite large. I would say more like 5 to 10 mobile homes, or maybe even a little more than that.
I've never seen a replica of it. I would like to. But anyway, if you were up there, say if it had a deck on the back of it, we'll say. I don't know if it does or not. You could sit in a chair and a table. I guess you'd have to have it anchored down where you wouldn't fly everywhere, I guess. Mm-hmm. And you took a radio with you. We'll say radio would be the Sea Crane, the one that you mentioned, the 2E.
The 2E. Yeah.
Yes. I got to get one of those one day when my present radio breaks. But anyway, because a lot of things aren't, technology can't use it. But anyway, what would you get? And say, would you feel the sun on your face on the outside? Like, what would you smell? What would you hear beside the space station? And like, if you clap your hands, what would you hear?
All right. Well, I'll tell you something, Charles. For one thing, they have, I guess you could call it the equivalent of a deck already. They've got something called the cupola, which was brought up and attached to ISS. It's a NASA module,
like
which is basically a kind of roundish room with windows all around. So half a sphere that you can look out. Now, it's zero gravity, so you float. You don't need a chair. You don't need a table. You float. If you wanna take pictures, you take your pictures with your camera. And then if you want to do something else, you'll just let go of the camera. It'll float there, and you pick it up when you need it. As for smell, it's first of all, it's an atmosphere. You're not in a spacesuit. And so they have very casual clothes they wear, and they float there, and it smells. I've gotten a variety of opinions from astronauts over the years about what it smells like in space. One Russian talked about the smell of aluminum, burnt metal, in one case, because there's metal. It's like a submarine. Think about, except it's more sophisticated than a submarine, has better circulation and so forth. So what does it smell like? Do you feel the sun? It depends on whether the sun is up or not, you know. Mm-hmm. They orbit the Earth every 90 minutes. So every 45 minutes, you have a sunset and a sunrise 45 minutes later. And so 45 minutes, you're in daylight. 45 minutes, you're in darkness. Keeps going. And so you have a wide variety of dark and light. When it's night, you can see the Earth. You can see the cities with their lights. When it's daytime, you have to avoid looking at the sun, but then you can see the surface features. Astronauts love looking at the Earth, taking pictures. That's amazing. It's just endless curiosity. They spend almost a large percentage of their spare time is spent looking at the Earth. Now, I'm not sure if the radio we're talking about is ham radio, but the astronauts are routinely ham radio experts, and they talk on the radio with the hams. That happens routinely.
It's got a ham band on it, that's for sure.
Yeah. So, yeah, oh, there's no question. This is a routine for ham. There's a lot of astronauts that have been ham experts and love to talk on the radio. And I know hams personally, know hams who've chatted with astronauts as they go by on ISS.
All right, let's go to Sherry in Memphis, Tennessee. Welcome to the show. Hi, Sherry.
Hi. I have several questions that really interest me.
All right.
What really happens in a black hole? Does it really eat everything that goes in there? And what happens when you have a nova, when it explodes and it radiates out through, does it give off a lot of particles which might set up asteroids? What really happens? And do any objects travel from galaxy to galaxy, maybe catch on to the gravity of another galaxy? And would you ever have a chance? Well, that's enough.
Yeah, Sherry, I'll go through them quick, all right? A black hole, well, the idea of a black hole is that you've got a lot of mass in a very, very small space, and the amount of gravity is so high that not even light can escape. You know, if I tried to jump up, I'd fall back down on the Earth. It holds me here, and it holds the atmosphere here. But the Earth isn't big enough or heavy enough to hold light in. Light bounces off the Earth. Black holes theorize it's compact and massive enough that even light cannot escape. Nothing can escape. So if something falls into the black hole, it can't get out. What happens when it goes into the black hole? Well, you know what? They don't know. It's a science. This is science on its cutting edge. We really don't know. All right, novas, supernovas, stars explode. There's a whole range. This all the life cycle of stars is something astronomers are researching and trying to understand now. They know that the death of stars, in some cases, depending on the star, dies in a supernova explosion. And that's a case where the star literally destroys itself in a gigantic explosion, sending out light and heat and gas and energy very fast and very powerfully. Nova explosions are different. They are stars that periodically explode, but not as big an eruption, and they don't destroy themselves when they do that. They just simply erupt and emit a lot of gas and material when they do so. And it's part of the evolutionary process of a star. Depending on how heavy the star is, it will evolve differently, and it'll have different kinds of later events in its life. As for galaxy to galaxy, well, you know, yes, there is actually travel from galaxy to galaxy, but it's more has to do with galaxies themselves moving about. Smaller galaxies eventually get eaten by bigger galaxies because of gravity. Once again, the bigger galaxy has a lot more gravity, more mass, and so when a smaller galaxy kind of travel is, you know, floating through space and they get near each other, it takes a long time. We're talking about billions and hundreds of millions of years, but eventually that smaller galaxy can be sucked in and absorbed by the larger galaxy. So that's about the only travel between galaxies. They're very far apart. I mean, to get to the nearest star, Proxima Centauri, which might have a, which has an Earth-like planet around it in the habitable zone, it's 4.5 light years away, and that would take more than a lifetime,
yeah.
Even the traveling at the fastest speed of rocket we have now to get to.
All right, Robert, we're going to come back with final calls in a moment. Since I was a little boy, Robert, space has been fun for me. How about you?
Oh, it's boring. That doesn't interest me. I don't get excited.
No, right.
You know,
Sell me some swampland, too, would you?
Well, it's the future. I'm always interested in the future, and space is the future. It is, and that's all there is to it. And it will always be the future because it is that final frontier. No matter what happens, eventually there will be no place else. It'll always be the place. It's unlimited horizons. As I said in the afterword to the paperback edition to Universe in a Mirror about the history of the Hubble Space Telescope, what space has given us is the endless horizon again.
Yes.
Once Magellan circled the globe, there was no longer endless horizon. We were basically on a world trapped. Even though there are lots of places to explore, even now there's lots of new places to explore, there's no endless horizon. We always know that horizon ends at some point at a place where other people have been. Space changes that. There's an endless horizon forever. we will never run out of a unknown territory beyond. And for a human species, that is priceless. That gives us something to strive for forever. And it gets me excited, and that's what the future is.
Let's go to Steve in Ocala, Florida, first-time caller. Hello, Steven. Go ahead.
Hey, hello.
Hi, Steve.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure thing.
Appreciate it. So I am a retired engineer, and I have this rock that came into my possession from the state of Georgia. And my expertise as an engineer was reverse engineering, and this rock definitely looks like molten rock. It's orange, light brown color, but it has some unique features because I'm a thread expert, and I have some features in here that looks like British road threads. So I really would like to know, is there a contact or a direction I can have on how to investigate this rock?
Oh, that's a really good question, Stephen. And off the top of my head, I must tell you, I can't answer that question right off. There are definitely amateur astronomers as well as professional geologists who could answer that question very quickly, and there are ways on the web to find them. If you go to Behind the Black and put a comment in, just anywhere, I'll see it, and that'll remind me, and I will look it up. I'll see if I can find a contact for you to research that. This question comes up a lot. 99% of the time, it's not a meteorite. It's not from off the Earth, but you know, nonetheless,
there are
people who would be glad to tell you one way or the other. So put a comment on Behind the Black, and maybe I can find out for you.
Bill in West Hartford, Connecticut. Hi, Bill. Welcome to the show.
Yes, hi, George. Yes, hi. Hi, Robert Zimmerman. I'm an amateur astronomer. I've talked to you many, many, many times in the past, and I know space science and astronomy to a T. And I have two great questions out of the most recent Aviation Week in Space Technology magazine, which I've subscribed to for years and years. So I'll ask both questions at the same time and have you answer both. Question number one, regarding the James Webb Space Telescope. In this article, it says Hubble will guide the James Webb Space Telescope in exoplanet observations. So question number one, you talked about Proxima B, the Earth-like planet in the habitable zone of the closest star to our solar system, Proxima Centauri. Question number one, do you think hopefully starting in 2018, almost exactly 2 years from now when James Webb is launched, will it have the capability of looking for biomarkers, meaning life markers, life signs in the atmosphere of Proxima B? Now, question number two, which involves the SLS rocket, which I know you don't like, the Space Launch System rocket and Orion spacecraft. But my point is, and this is question number two, I think what will save the SLS, what will save the Space Launch System, make it worth give it the bang for the buck, is not so much the manned program in Orion, but three space science unmanned missions. The high-definition space telescope, which the SLS will be able to launch definitely because it has a 28 feet diameter core stage. And the other two science missions are a orbiter and lander or flyby and lander of Jupiter's moon Europa and an orbiter and lander or flyby and lander of Saturn's moon Enceladus. So question number two, do you think with the launch of the HDST High Definition Space Telescope, which will dwarf the James Webb, let alone dwarf the Hubble, and potentially be launched in the early 2030s, along with the Europa mission and the Enceladus mission, would that maybe pay for the SLS?
Well, Bill, you always ask really great questions.
He does.
I remember you previous times, and I really like it when you call because you do ask good questions. In terms of James Webb, we have to always remember James Webb was designed to look in the infrared, so it will look at different things than Hubble will. Hubble will look in the looks in the optical. Hubble is the telescope that will not die. They just extended its contract, the operational contract, till 2021. So they will hopefully both be in orbit, both operational at the same time, and therefore they really work together, complement of each other. Webb doesn't replace Hubble. It's a complementary. They will do different things. So yes, they can both be looking at Proxima B and provide us information about it. Would Webb be able to give us biomarkers, I'm not so sure. In fact, I would think Hubble would be better at that because it's got the spectroscopy data. I think that would be of more use, but I could be wrong on that. Obviously, having them both look at a potential exoplanet that could be habitable will give us a wealth of information, and that's the best I can say about that. As for SLS, you know, it is Congress that has demanded that SLS be used to launch the Europa mission. The problem with using SLS for any of this is the cost. As I pointed out, $43 billion to build three capsules and two rockets. $43 billion. Well, if you just, the rockets, divide that in half, that's $21.5 billion per rocket. Now, of course, this is development cost, so it wouldn't be quite that much, but I've seen numbers. They generally run in the range of around 10 to 14 billion per launch. That's almost NASA's entire yearly budget. The science program can't afford it. They will be forced to use it for Europa, because the money won't be coming out of the science budget. But if science has to pay for launches on SLS, they won't be able to launch anything. The only way SLS works is if it's mandated by Congress, who then gives the money to do it. It's important to note that Congress, though it's financed the first two rockets and three capsules, has not funded anything beyond that. And to be honest, I don't know how they will be able to afford it. I also know that once the private industry starts to launch regularly, such as the Falcon Heavy, and doing things for a tenth the cost and much more effectively, it's going to become increasingly difficult to spend the money on SLS when you've got something that can do the same thing for a lot less.
Robert, did NASA really spend $300 for a screwdriver and things like that?
No, that was actually a Defense Department mistake. NASA's a government program. Government programs tend to not be cost effective. They tend not to think about the bottom line. They think about their project, the program they have, which is like NASA's SLS. They're thinking about the program, and so the program has almost a carte blanche and costs a lot. It's not that they're necessarily trying to waste money or that they are dishonest. It's that their priority is not, say, making a profit. When you have a priority of making a profit, you have to do things smart and efficiently. You can't waste dollars. You have to figure out how to do it smart without costing a lot. And so that puts a limit. It's kind of like the old saying, you know, the hangman's noose focuses the mind. Well, in this case, if you force people to keep profit in mind, it forces them to focus their mind and they don't waste money. So no, NASA has never spent $300 on a screwdriver. That was the Pentagon. But NASA has been inefficient a lot of times in getting things done because their focus is not in trying to do it effectively or efficiently, I should say, cheaply.
Let's go to John in Houston, Texas. Hey, John, go ahead.
I was just wondering about the 96% of the universe that has apparently gone missing. Do we have to get like a giant milk carton or something?
Well, John, the universe, I have a theme on Behind the Black for a lot of my posts, which I call the uncertainty of science. And the most important thing about science is that it's uncertain. In fact, if you're a good scientist, you relish the uncertainty because nothing is settled. There's a lot of uncertainty, and you learn from the uncertainty. Well, when it comes to dark matter and dark energy, which are two different things, two different mysteries, supposedly astronomers tell us, cosmologists tell us, they compose something like 90% of the universe, and that's 90% of the universe. We have no idea what it is. Having said that, that just tells me that science is astronomy especially, is an extremely uncertain business right now, and there are mysteries out there which we don't have a handle on, and I think that's incredibly cool. I relish that uncertainty.
What do you think of the fact that, I mean, since the 30s, they've known that this huge portion of the universe is unobservable, unmeasurable. Is there, you know, maybe we're the 4%, we're at the kids' table, you know, for the holiday dinner. You know, maybe we got put here. Maybe we were sequestered.
Well, you know, that's a good question. I don't know. I will tell you that it's very important to understand that there are two different questions here having to do with the missing parts of the universe. One is dark matter, which is something that was discovered in the 50s because galaxies rotate on their outer perimeters much faster than they should.
Yeah, that was in,
a lot
that
of
was in like 75. You know,
again?
That only accounts for 22%.
Yes.
Of the universe that is missing.
That's right. And the other is the dark energy, which was a discovery in the late 90s, which is that the universe appears to be accelerating as it gets bigger on vast scales instead of slowing down. And that suggests there's some form of energy in the fabric of the universe itself that is forcing the space itself to expand faster. Now, what I've just said, if you could see me, I'm waving my hands because it's back of the envelope hand waving by cosmologists when they say that. They don't really understand this. And their data, I don't care what they say, is incredibly uncertain. It is built on a lot of assumptions and there's not a lot of actually hard data. So a lot of what we think we know might turn out not to be true, and we have to be very aware of that. So, all right, now, the thing about the universe, Bill, is that it has been given to us as a mystery. Things are not obvious. What we think is obvious, if we dig deep, we find it's not so obvious, such as, it seems obvious the sun revolves around the Earth. I mean, it seems obvious the sun revolves around the Earth. Well, you got to dig a little deeper to learn that it's not the case. And that applies to the planets and the solar system. It seemed obvious that the whole universe was filled with stars scattered evenly about. No, it isn't. They live in galaxies that are separate from each other and far apart from each other. And I could go on a list for a number of knowledge we've gained that was not obvious. And this applies to what dark energy and dark matter are, the missing matter. There is a mystery there that we have uncovered, but we have not dug deep enough yet to find out what the answer to that mystery is. And the way the universe is, once we answer that mystery, I guarantee there will be another mystery below it, which will be just as intriguing and fascinating.
Take a few more calls here east of the Rockies. We've got Carl in Orlando, Florida now. Carl, go ahead, sir.
Hello, George and Robert. How are you?
Good, Carl.
Thank you, my call. Yes.
Thank you.
Two quick questions. First of all, on the universe expansion. The way I understand it, at least after the big...
Well, I think we lost you. Did we lose you?
Oh, that's too bad.
Oh, what do you think he was going
to
say?
Well, I mean, people always ask about the universe expansion, and the analogy I like to give to try to explain it is, take a balloon, blow it up a little bit, put dots on it, then blow it up some more and look at the dots. Any dot you look at is going to appear like it's in the center and all the other dots are moving away from it. But you look at a different dot and no, that's in the center and all the dots are moving away from it. And that's what the expansion of the universe is. It isn't that there is a center and everything's moving from it. It's that the space between the dots, the balloon, the space, the fabric of space itself, is expanding. That's the concept. And that's what's understood. That's the concept. I leave it there.
All right. Next up, Brian is in Indianapolis. Hey, Brian, go ahead.
Hello, George. It's so great to talk to you.
I'm glad you got in.
I'd like to start out by just saying that I was born in Walker Air Force Base Hospital, Roswell, New Mexico.
Aha.
And my point tonight is just a realization that our universe is by mega majority in darkness. And if you were able to place yourself in between solar systems out into the darkness, it would be so dark that you could not see yourself or anything else. It would be just like you were blind, and the only thing that your eyes could visualize is the points of light that are stars that are in the universe.
I would say that's true, without question, Brian. The universe is very vast. We can't even imagine how vast
it
is.
And I bet there are many universes, Robert.
Yeah, you know, let's not just talk about space, the vastness of space. Let's talk about the vastness of time. We talk about millions of years, hundreds of thousands of years, you know, the various epochs where dinosaurs existed 65 million years ago. 65 million years is a really long time. We bandy the numbers about, but let's really think about how long that is. It's a long enough period of time for continents, mountains to grow and collapse, you know. So we do not have a real understanding of the vastness of the universe, and that's just the bottom line. And that's one of the reasons the mysteries here are so cool, because there's opportunity here for a lot of exploration for the rest of the history of the human race.
Robert, almost out of time. Got about a minute or so left. Let's get one more caller. Ron is in California. See if we can squeeze you in. Ron, go ahead real fast.
Okay, what is your opinion of the Black Knight satellite?
Have you heard of that, Robert?
I've heard of it. I looked it up. In fact, this was a question that came up on a previous show with you a while back, and then I looked it up afterward and researched it, and now I don't remember what my research came up with.
Something's going around the planet, they say.
Say again?
Something's going around the planet, they say. Who knows?
There's lots of satellites going around the planet. The Black Knight satellite
has been something that apparently has been going around. This is a theory. 2,000 years sent by another life force from a different planetary system to monitor us.
Well, if there was a satellite going around the Earth like that, the Air Force would know about it, because they track things as small as a screwdriver, inches across, because they want to make sure space junk doesn't destroy satellites. And I'm not aware of anything like that.
All right, Robert, my friend. Thank you for spending a couple hours with us.